I wanted to start tonight by asking you a really, really simple question, but it's got profound implications. So you really have to think deeply about this question before you just go, yeah, sure. The question is, do you really trust God? Think about that for a minute. Do you really trust God? Not do you trust Him as in for salvation. Not do you trust Him as in for taking care of your basic needs. I mean, do you really trust Him? Do you really submit yourself to His decrees, His lead, and who He is? Do you really trust God? Do you really? We're picking up in Exodus chapter 17. And we did Exodus 16 last time, 2 weeks ago, and we did Exodus 15 before that. And so Exodus 17, and we're just going to read seven verses. So let's dive right in. In verse 1 of Exodus 17, all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sinai by stages. Okay, now remember where they are. In fact, what happened in the last chapter without looking? Somebody tell me.
It's been 2 weeks.
Huh? What? Yeah, manna. Manna shows up, right? What happens? What does God tell them to do? Take only what you need, get enough for that day. How much does Moses tell them to take? Yeah, basically, like a big cup. A big cup full, and that's enough. If they took too much, what happened to the manna? It rotted, and what showed up in it? Maggots or worms showed up in it, and it smelled awful, right? If they didn't take too much and they had, if they just took what they needed, did they have enough? Yes, they had more than enough, because if they just took what they needed, there was still some left out. So God provides extravagantly for His people and then tells them, only take what you need. What did He do at night for them, the first night? Huh? Light? No. Close though. Quail, right. He gave them quail. So the first night they get there and they're like, we're hungry. And God's like, quail from heaven. And it falls, right? And they cook it and eat it. Well, so that's what's just happened. God has provided miraculously big circles of bread on the ground every morning. That's enough for their day. What happened on the Sabbath day? What were they supposed to do the day before the Sabbath? Get enough for 2 days. Right. Get enough for 2 days. And then they'd take it for 2 days. Now, that's just happened. So from there, they leave the wilderness of sin, or sign, however you want to say it. There's no implications there, by the way. That's not the same word as sin. That's just the Hebrew name, sign, right? So they leave that place, and they leave by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and they camped at Rephidim. Now, the word Rephidim here, it comes from the root word rafad, which means refreshing or resting. So this name, where they go in the wilderness, is going to tell you something of what's about to happen. They're about to be refreshed. So something in their mind is about to be refreshed to God. So Rephidim, they go to Rephidim, which means refreshings, because the I am on the end of a Hebrew word is plural. Right? So, Rephidim, right? So, that's plural, Rephidim. So, he goes there, and they're about to be refreshed, but there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water. And they grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So there's a couple things we can see here. Number one, when you come back from a place where God has provided for you, He's met all your needs, and there's a time period of rest or a time period or there's a break in God's work. When you come back for a place like that, there's some temptations that you face. The first one is to grumble about God. Now, Israel goes to Rephidim, and they are resting, and nothing is happening, and they get thirsty. So trials come at Rephidim, at refreshing. Trials come at the place of refreshing. And then and in the same way, when we are at rest, we sometimes become complacent. When we come to a place where we have to rely on God after having been provided for by God miraculously and taken care of by God, we get complacent. And complacency breeds quarrelsomeness. They come to the place of Rephidim, and they come to rest, and just like they came to refreshing, or they came to a place where God was going to refresh them, they ended up meeting a trial, and all of a sudden, their complacency catches up with them. You see, their complacency of not pursuing exactly the Lord for themselves, and trusting in the Lord, not trusting in the Lord, leads them to grumble and quarrel. And if you'll notice what Moses says, whenever you grumble and quarrel against the leaders appointed by God who are leading you, you test the Lord. This is a common theme in Scripture. In fact, when Nathan comes to David after David has sinned with Bathsheba and has taken something that's not rightfully his, what does Nathan say? He doesn't say, "Why have you slept with this woman?" He doesn't do that. He says, "Why have you despised the word of the Lord?" Because when you sin, when you fail to trust God, when you fail to be faithful to God's word, you are despising what God has said He will do. And you're despising His word. And that's exactly what they're doing here. They come to the place of refreshing and they grumble. Now they've become complacent, right? They got comfortable with God providing for them without need for asking. And this is, by the way, this is the third time they've complained. Third time since they crossed the Red Sea. Right? Third time. They complain constantly. First they come to the place where the water is bitter. And they come to bitter, and the water was bitter, and therefore it was bitter. So they named the place bitter. Right? You remember that? Chapter 15, right? The end of chapter 15. They come to that place, and they go, "Why is there no water for us to drink?" And Moses goes, "Lord, what'd you do sending me these complaining people?" And they, you know, then God's like, "Throw a log in there." And He throws the log in the water. It gets better. Remember? Then they come to the place, they come to the desert in Sinai, and they stand before God, and they go, "We're hungry!" And they complain to Moses again. And every time they complain, "Wasn't it better for us before in Egypt?" Every single time. Every time they complain, that's their complaint. "Wasn't it better for us when we were in Egypt?" And I want to pose to you, before we go any further, when you fail to trust the Lord, you do the same thing. You say to God, "Wasn't it better when I didn't know you?" That's exactly what you do. When you fail to trust the Lord with your life, you fail to worship God. And we're going to see in a bit that that also is a form of idol worship, but we'll get there in a minute. The second thing I want to point out to you is when you are complacent in your walk, you misdirect your blame. When you're complacent in your walk, you misdirect your blame. So if you're not trusting in the Lord for all your provision, you're going to blame people whose fault it isn't. You're going to blame the leaders. You're going to blame the guy you're with, the girl you're with. You're going to blame your friends. You're going to blame your parents. You're going to blame somebody whose fault it is not their fault. And you misdirect the blame because God is the one who can handle your blame. Let me say that again. God is the one who can handle your blame. So you come to God with your trials. You come to God with your complaints. You come to God with your struggles because God is the one who can handle the problem. He's the one who can fix it. But if you're complacent in your walk and you've gotten used to God and you've forgotten that He's the one that provides, then you misdirect the blame. Just like the people of Israel here, they blame Moses. Now, second, the question is, who is it that you are testing? And I just wanted to remind you what we've learned constantly in the book of Exodus. Grumbling is always and completely always against God. Every aspect of grumbling that happens, Moses says, why do you test the Lord? Every time they grumble. Why do you test God? Every time you grumble or complain, it's not against men. It's against God. Your response ought to be to worship God, seek His will, and then do what He says. not to complain about your circumstance. Because when you complain, you test the Lord. That's what we're learning in the book of Exodus, over and over and over. You complain, you're testing God. You grumble, you're testing God. You're saying He's not good enough. You're not trusting Him. Now, Moses, his response is really profound when he says, why do you grumble against me? Look at that in verse 3. I think it's verse 3. No, it's verse 2. He says, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? Look at what the people of Israel aren't arguing with God. Are they? And they're not calling God out and saying, Lord, you did this and I think that's wrong. No, because one, they're not that dumb. They're close, but they're not that dumb. And two, they're not at all focused on God or trusting in Him. Instead, what they're doing is they're grumbling and complaining about Moses. And Moses is like, why do you test the Lord? You see this. Moses' response, why do you quarrel with me, comma, why do you test the Lord? So Moses recognizes something. Moses recognized that God has spoken to him. And the people recognize that too, because earlier in the book, you're going to follow God. Yeah, we're going to follow God. Lead us, Moses. Right? So they quarrel with Moses, and by doing so, they test God. And the second thing I want you to notice about that, about who you're testing, is when periods of silence come, this is one of the things we can see in this text. When periods of silence come, when God has not provided for you immediately, when these periods of silence come, it's not accidental. God knows what He's doing. It's not a mistake. So when periods of silence come at God's hands and He doesn't answer you right away, well, you're at refreshing. The thing we can learn from Israel here is that they're at rephidim, refreshings. God's silence does not mean absence of God. Rather, it means you must turn to Him and trust Him. And Moses does that, right? Let's read on. Verse 4. So Moses cried to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah, which by the way means testing, and Meribah, which means quarreling, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested Yahweh by saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now, I want you to take note of some of his instructions, right? This is kind of cool. God tells Moses, okay, go get your stick and go get the elders. Now, we call it a staff because it's poetic, but the word means stick. Go get the stick that you hit the Nile with and get the elders. So he goes and gets the stick, right? And he walks over and he strikes the rock. Everybody gets a picture, right? Everybody's got the picture? Now, with him, he's got at least 12 elders, 12 older men. At least 12, probably more like 30, 40, maybe even 50, because they're the elders of Israel. So each tribe, there are 12 tribes, each tribe has elders, right, that lead and direct, and they're old guys with, you know, canes, and they walk funny, you know, and they're those guys, right? So he goes and gets them, and he says, okay, come with me, I'm gonna strike this rock, and water's going to come out. And he gets the elders. So I want you to notice a couple things. Number one, he tells him to take the stick with him. That's kind of important. He says, take the stick with which you struck the Nile. What's the stick the symbol of? Anybody remember? Nobody does. Okay. The stick is the symbol of what God has done for Moses and the people of Israel in the past. That's what he's carrying. He's carrying their history of freedom. He's carrying the shepherd's staff that he took with him. Their history of freedom. Strikes the Nile with it, strikes the dust with it, and miraculous things happen, raises it in the sky, and the sea parts. This is the history of their freedom from Israel, from bondage. Israel's freedom from bondage. So in the same way, when God tells you it's time to rest, there's some things that we can draw from this, right? Number one, take the history of God and what He has done in your past with you. When you meet a trial, when you meet something that's difficult, take what God has done in your past with you. And the question arises again, do you really trust God? Because God reminds Moses, hey, Moses, get the stick I took with you that you struck the Nile with. Moses is like, oh yeah, you did all that. Right? I mean, that's what God reminds him. Look, this is your history. This is who I brought you out to be. In the same way, this is why, by the way, we harp so much on you learning what a Christian is. On you learning that a Christian has a new nature, is set apart, is different, is changed from the inside out. We harp on that because you need to carry the history of what God's done for you and with you along your journey. Go get the staff. That's the first one, right? Go get the staff. Take it with you. Second, he says, take the elders of Israel with you. Okay, now listen, you face trials in your life. You face these trials in your life. God says, bring your history with you. Remember what I've done. The second thing he says is take some wise counsel. Take some wise counsel with you. Now, these are the people who are grumbling. They're no better than Moses. In fact, Moses is probably better than they are. But they're the ones who are grumbling about it. And God's like, all right, take your wise counsel and go show them who I am. So sometimes your wise counsel is not going to be the greatest. I mean, in fact, I imagine Moses is like, I don't want them coming along. They're just going to complain the whole way. Right? I mean, that's probably what happened. God was like, take the elders with you. And he was like, do I have to? Those guys stink. And Bill, he smells funny. Do I really have to take them with me? Yes, take the elders with you. Oh, come on. They're just going to complain the whole time. Oh. He does what you guys do. And so then he takes the stick and the elders with him. So he takes some wise counsel with him. And sometimes your wise counsel is not always going to be the greatest. This is why your counsel first and foremost comes from God and not from men or friends. Your counsel first and foremost comes from God. And if your wise counsel doesn't lead you to God's counsel, if your wise counsel doesn't point you to the Scripture, probably not the best counsel. It's probably not. The best counsel is going to come from the text. So he tells him, take the staff, take the elders with you, and go strike the rock. Now, I want you to know something. The question arises again. Do you really trust God? And he's looking at Israel. And he's like, do you really? Good. You can put that question up there. Do you really trust God? And he's going to say, it's going to pop up over and over. Do you really trust God? He just told Moses, go hit a rock with a stick. And think about it. Think about it. You're in the desert. You're thirsty. You got a couple thousand people, maybe even more with you. They're all thirsty, and they're about to stone you. And God says, go pick up that stick I gave you and hit a rock. How crazy does that sound? That is not a sane thing to say. It's bizarre. It's weird. Do you really trust God? Because I think He's going to tell you some things sometimes that don't make any sense. That don't make any sense at all. Like when he told my wife and I, hey, you guys need to move back to Texas. No job. You got a job up there. No job. You've got to go. And we had to go. It didn't make any sense. It wasn't logical. It was like God telling Moses, throw a stick in a river that's polluted, and it'll be better. It's like God telling Moses, strike a rock with a stick and I'll take care of everything. And that's what sometimes some things seem crazy. But if you're listening and you're following, the question remains, do you trust God? Do you trust God to provide your spouse? Do you trust God to take care of your family? Do you trust God to tell you where to go to school? Do you trust God with your future? Do you trust God with the things that you own and possess? Do you hold them out to Him with an open hand? If He wants to take them back, He can. Or do you say, God can take anything except this? God can take anything except, I don't know, for me, God can take anything except my dog. I'm just being funny. But, seriously, do you hold these things out to God with an open hand? I got to tell you how hard it is to hold your spouse out as an open hand. And how many times idolatry has been seen in my heart because I've told God anything but that. And how many times He's corrected me and led me to say, even that. Even that. Do you really trust God? Do you really trust God to take care of these things? And do you? Flip with me to 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 5. Paul talks about this passage. One of the things that you need to know, as you're turning there, I just want to tell you. God says to Moses, I will stand before you on the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock. Now see, what God says to him is that in plain language, I am the rock, hit me, and I'll give you water. You see, in the language, the word rock and the word God are standing before you on the rock are so closely tied together, and they're so close together, that what God seems to be telling him is, I'm going to stand where you strike. Strike the rock, and living water will flow from it. Strike the rock that is God, and living water will flow from it. Now, Paul's going to tell us in this passage that this rock followed them through the wilderness. And I personally think they saw this rock everywhere they went. Like they traveled and they saw a rock and it looked like the one he struck. They went from one place to another. There's that rock again. And I'm just thinking, how cool would it be if the rock was in the shape of a cross? How cool would it be? I can't prove that. That's not in the text. So don't go home and, there was a cross that followed Israel. No, there wasn't. But how cool would it be if God made the rock in the shape of a cross? Because that's what it symbolizes. Christ gets struck in the New Testament and living water flows from Him. And salvation comes from Him. And then it follows that salvation, that rock, follows believers all their life. And stays with them all their life. How flippin' awesome is that? Now, that's pretty stinking incredible. That God painted the same picture in Exodus that He gives you in the New Testament. Now Paul, writing to the people at Corinth, writes, I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers, that's the Israelites, were all under the cloud. Remember the cloud that led them by day, fire, pillar of fire by night. We're all under the cloud. And all passed through the sea and were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So he wants you to understand, they passed through the water just like we get dunked as a symbol of their salvation. Right? And so he goes on and he says, verse 3, and all ate the same spiritual food. Remember, manna fell from heaven. The same food, they all intook it. They all took it in. There you go. verse 4. And all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. And the rock was Christ. Now listen, their sustenance, who they were, was filled by Christ. Israel was able to survive because of Christ. Because of His filling in their life. Do you really trust God to do that? Do you really trust Him? Then he goes on in verse 5 and he says, nevertheless, this is the disappointing part. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. God gave them food, gave them water, wherever they needed it. And they were overthrown in the wilderness. They were overthrown in the wilderness. I just have this feeling that some of us are on the verge of being overthrown in the wilderness. That some of us need to reconsider whether or not we really have believed. And if we haven't, we need to desperately. We need to desperately. Now flip with me to John chapter 4. Jesus is talking to this woman at a well. And this is by far my favorite story of when Jesus talks to somebody. Because I think it's exactly where we are as a culture. Just a heads up. I think this is who we are as a culture. This woman exemplifies us. Chapter 4, verse 1. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself didn't really baptize, but only his disciples did, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. Pardon me. And he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour. Just a heads up. This is one of the proofs that C.S. Lewis gives for this not being mythology. He gives you time of day because it says, this is a total side note. When you have myths, they don't get daytimes. They get like, and the sun was high in the sky. They give you things like that. They don't give you daytimes. This is one of the reasons we know that the Bible is not medieval literature or Gnostic myths. This is one of the reasons we know this. Because it says Jesus, tired, sat down by a well at the sixth hour. So this is one of the proofs of why it is not myth. Okay, so Jesus sits down. And there came a woman of Samaria to drink water. And Jesus said to him, give me a drink. Now, this is not impolite in that time period. I know it sounds impolite. Like, somebody walks up, she's drawing water, and Jesus is like, hey, give me a drink. I will take you out, you don't give me a drink. Right? I mean, that's what it sounds like. But that's not what's happening here. This is common. This is something that's normal. Somebody comes to the water, and you're sitting by the water, and you want something to drink, and they've got something to draw with, and you don't, you say, hey, can I have a drink? And yeah, sure. You know, that's just common courtesy in that time period. But the woman looks at Jesus, and look at what she says. For his disciples, verse 9. The Samaritan woman said to him, how is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For the Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. Now, Samaritans are half-breeds. So this is a racial thing. Samaritans are half-breeds. They're part Jew, part Canaanite. Right, it happened during the exile from Babylon. Some people were left in Israel, and they interbred with other people. So they're half breeds, and they started a whole group that worshipped on a mountain where Jacob worshipped, rather than worshiping in Jerusalem. So they had this big worship war, right? And this was a very intellectual woman, and so she goes, why would you, a Jew man, talk to me, a Samaritan woman? Two strikes against Jesus there, by the way. Woman and Samaritan half-breed. So he's not supposed to be talking to her because, what is it in Deuteronomy? That pure, you're supposed to be pure, not interbreed with people. So this woman is essentially an outcast from society, from Jewish society. The only place she can find refuge is with other half-breeds. So Jesus comes to her and says, hey, can you give me some water? And it just throws her world out of whack. Wait. What are you talking to me for? I'm a woman, and I'm a Samaritan. And Jesus just looks at her and is like, yep, And I love his response. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was that's saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Now, I just want you to think about this for a minute. She's a woman. This is a man. This is an unmarried man. She's an unmarried woman. She comes to the well. He says, "Give me a drink." And she says, "Why would you even ask me this?" You know, she goes all intellectual on him. And he goes, "If you knew what a great gift of God is in front of you, you would have asked me for a drink." Doesn't that sound like a really bad pickup line? I mean, doesn't it? But she doesn't go there. She doesn't go there. And I'm grateful for that, because that would ruin the story. But she doesn't go there. Instead, she goes the high route and begins to talk about religion. We're going to come back to the same question over and over tonight. Do you really trust God? This woman comes back to the same idea. Religion. He says, "If you would have asked me, and I would have given you living water." Jesus says, "No, the reality is here." She says, "Why would you even ask me? I'm a Samaritan woman. You're a Jewish man." And Jesus says, "Listen, the reality is I have something greater for you than you could possibly comprehend." And so he looks at her and goes, "You just missed the boat." And she goes like this. This is what she says. The woman said to him, this is verse 11, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Now she turns it on him, right? And she says, "Look, this is Jacob's well. This is God-sanctioned water here. This is God-sanctioned. This is like if they bottled it would say approved by God, right? That's what it would say." But that's where she goes with it. And she says, "And you don't have anything to draw the water with." So she does two things. One, she says, "Listen, sir, the reality is you don't have anything to draw water with. And this is God's water. This is Jacob's well." So she goes the high road again and goes religion and says, "Listen, I worship the God of Jacob. I know this. I know this religious stuff works. I'm trusting in this religious stuff." And he hits her again. Check it out. And Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water I will give him will never be thirsty forever. And the water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up into eternal life." He got her. All of a sudden, she drops the religion. All of a sudden, she recognizes, for a split second, she goes back to it in a minute. For a split second, she realizes her religion and her practices are not going to save her. For a split second, she recognizes it. And look at what she says. "Sir, give me this water so that I will never be thirsty and not have to draw water from here again." For a split second, she got it and lost it. Split second, she saw, "Oh, if this is true, then this religious stuff I'm talking about, I don't have to do this. I can have reality." For a split second, then she loses it. "So that I don't have to come here again." All of a sudden, she gets back onto the whole bump of, "I know what I'm doing. I'm fine the way I am." Now look at what Jesus says. This is awesome, by the way. It's just brilliant. Jesus, he's the man. He says to her, "Go and call your husband and come here." And the woman goes, "I don't have a husband." And Jesus goes, "You're right. You're right in saying that you don't have a husband. For you've had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." So the woman turns it on him again. "Well, what I'm doing is fine. This is working fine. All this stuff I'm trying to do on my own is fine." Jesus, "All right then, if it's so fine, go get your husband." In other words, Jesus looks at her and goes, "You don't get it. Your life is jacked up." And she's like,
whoa, I don't have a husband. And he's like, that's right, you don't have a husband. In fact, you've jacked up 5 relationships. And now you're with a man who is not even your husband. So you're not only, you're living in immorality and sin. It's wild. I mean, just the response Jesus gives her is hilarious. And then he goes on, and he says, or she says to him, sir, she goes the religion route again. Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. So she misses the boat again. Jesus says, I'm the living water. Like he said that. I can give you living water. And she goes, but what I'm doing is working fine. And he goes, no, it isn't. Your life is jacked up. And she's like, sir, I see that you're a prophet. Or, I guess in modern terms, it'd be like, obviously, you're one of those believers. You're one of those radical people that's all weird and hippie-like and just ask the Lord. You know, I mean, seriously. Obviously, that's who you are. And Jesus responds to her, and she says, so she asks him a theological question. She's like, okay, if my religion's not working for me, which one is? Which one is? It's like, what? What? Your religion's not working for you either, right? And she picks this fight with him. And Jesus, his answer is brilliant. Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor on Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Religion doesn't solve it. Religious practice doesn't, thank you so much. Religious practice does not solve it. Living water, get it? Huh? Yeah. Okay, so, religion, back on track. Religious practice does not solve the problem. Coming to Wednesday night does not solve your problem. Coming to church does not solve your problem. All it does is show you the answer. The following of Jesus Christ is what solves the problem. The striking of the rock is what solves the problem. He looks at her and says, listen, the practice here and in Jerusalem, none of it matters. It doesn't matter. You worship here, you worship, who cares where you worship? Who cares what mountain you stand on and pray? The point is not where or how or even by what method, but who. Who you worship. And the question arises again, do you really trust God? The woman looks at him and says, I've been trusting my religion. Do you really trust God? Because God offers something more than religion. He offers you Himself. Not some penny-like religion that you can stick a quarter in and get salvation. Do you really trust God? And he goes on and he says, you worship what you do not know. Ouch, by the way. If you're that woman and you're all intellectual, and she's like, I worship on this hill here, and you worship over there. He's like, you worship what you don't know. Ouch. It's like, I mean, it's a cut, right? And then he says, you worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship Him. God is spirit. And those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. You see, the woman wanted to provide for herself by religious practice. By religion, and she was trusting in that to protect her and take care of her. And Jesus shows up and goes, that's not going to cut it. But rather, Jesus says, I'm going to provide for reality. God provides for reality. God provides for the things that are real. The things that actually exist. God provides for the things that are spiritual, that are beyond what you feel, beyond what you see, but what is true reality.
I know that some of that just went right over some of your heads, but stick with me. You'll pick it up. God provides for what is real. And the question Jesus comes to, the woman says to him, I know, she's, now understand, she's broken at this point in the conversation. She's lost. Any argument she had, it's gone. It's done. She can't argue anymore. I mean, Jesus is just like, that argument stinks, that argument stinks, that argument stinks, that argument stinks. Oh, you got nothing left, huh? And the woman looks at him, throws out the one thing she knows that's left that's true. Throws out the one thing about her religion that's true, that she knows is real. She says, I know that a Messiah is coming. And when he comes, he'll tell us everything. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. You see, Jesus just told her everything. Jesus just answered everything. And he came back to the same question. Do you really trust God? Comes back to that over and over. Do you really trust him? Is he really your guide for everything? Is he really the guiding light in your life? Or do you hold back with some things and put forward your open hand with a few things? Do you really trust him? Because if you really trust him, the rock that was stricken in the desert, that provided water and followed them around, is the same spiritual rock that's stricken for you in Jesus. He's the same one that provides life for you in Jesus. That's what Paul says, 1 Corinthians 10. It's the same one. And if you're trusting anything other than that, if you trust anything other than that, then you are guilty of idol worship. You see, Paul in chapter 10 of Corinthians goes on to say that the Jews who were in the desert, because of their lack of trust, give us an example of idol worship. If your trust is in anything else, if your trust is in, well, I know that I've got this right here. I know that I can keep this here. As long as I can keep this, I'm happy. If your trust is in anything like this, idol worship. That's what that is. If anything is ultimate besides Christ, it's idol worship. So do you trust Jesus? I mean, do you really? Is he really your ultimate?